You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 345. And in this one, I got back on Dr. Sam Greenblatt. Sam is a licensed clinical psychologist, and in this episode, we discuss an update on his past relapse, his fire metaphor, processing the trauma of OCD, meta-OCD, PTSD in OCD, identity in OCD, and the idea of perceived fragility. We discuss loss and grief around OCD, and figuring out what is normative, and much more. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers affordable, effective, and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories, or the link will be in the episode description. So thank you to Sam for his time. I deeply appreciate it. And of course, thank you to you guys for listening. It means a lot. Without further ado, here is Sam. Welcome back to the show, Sam.
Great to be back.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. So, as you know, it'd be good to get an update on you. And also here, obviously, last time you came on, you talked a bit about a relapse you had. It'd be good to see how you're doing on that front.
Yeah, I think that's been the episodic journey of my appearances on the podcast here, where I think maybe around the second appearance, I was going through one of the most significant upheavals of OCD in my life, where my theme of OCD is relationship OCD, always has been since the first relationship I was ever in. And I got engaged to my now wife about a year ago today, about a year ago today. And around that time, what had been OCD that was more in the back burner that would kind of pop up during significant stressors, but after having been through my own therapy, it was very manageable. My OCD popped up to kind of some of the most intense rates that I've ever experienced it. So it was a great challenge, but also a great learning opportunity, right? The reason that I'm in this field and the reason that I'm so interested in OCD and OCD treatment, just because I identify so much with it. And you could get kind of comfortable as a clinician saying, oh, well, this worked for me like years ago. And, you know, if I could do it, you could do it. And, you know, good luck. But to go through the severity of OCD, and when I say severe at its worst, it was that kind of OCD that almost mimics like psychosis, right? Where it's just constant voices in your head that's screaming at you that you're in danger, and just inability to sleep. I mean, at its worst, like there was a week where I was just having smoothies because I couldn't even hold down or eat like solid foods. I'll remember that week for a long time. But I'm happy to say that over the course of that journey, through introspection, through rereading, you know, all of the kind of texts, going through a lot of skills and doubling down on practicing what I preach. At this point, I think I'm back to, you know, my baseline of before that whole situation, have been for a few months now, and not the type of recovered where, you know, you're kind of nervous that OCD is around the corner and, oh, I think that it's gone for now, but what if it comes back? But in that really kind of act inspired mentality of, I'm totally welcoming of any of these thoughts happening again, of experiencing any of these kind of feelings or fears or urges or sensations again. And I think I'm in a much healthier place.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. And yeah, like I think I said, I don't know if I said on the last podcast, but I was having a bit of a relapse around the end of last year. And then we recorded that in January, I think, this year. And you talked about the campfire and like no more logs, like don't put any more logs, so your compulsions on the fire. And so I remember that mantra kind of came in useful for me. I'd in the situation remind myself like no more logs, you know.
That's
no
excellent.
More, like be stubborn with it, and yeah, along with other stuff. But yeah, I just found that really useful, that saying.
I think that's a great axiom, and your wife did that beautiful illustration of it as well. Yeah, I think after you've had some intense OCD, you could almost, it's meant in a more ACT way, but I'm going to use like an unskillful term. You could almost use that resentment of having gone through such a challenging time as inspiration. You know, that like no more logs, like I am not doing that again. You know, that bonfire was really intense. I know that although this compulsion is incredibly tempting, it's going to be a log, right? Maybe if you put a log on a fire, it, you know, the fire might die down for a second because it's deprived of oxygen for that second that you're dropping a huge log onto it. But yeah, it's going to burn brighter. It's going to burn longer, and you have to sit with those consequences.
Yeah. That's it. So yeah, it's kind of reminding yourself of that short-term payoff. Like or wanting the long-term payoff, which is not putting the log on, and that's going to be scary.
Yeah, but
it's only for a short time. It's riding it out. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad you're doing better.
Thank you.
So we're obviously going to talk about the things that happen, I don't want to say after OCD, but kind of as we start to work through it. So I may have titled this episode like in the wake of OCD.
Sure.
So there's a few topics we'll go over, but the first one is kind of processing the trauma of having had OCD in a big way, or severe OCD. So I guess, what is the trauma of OCD?
Yeah, so to contextualize like the content of today's episode, it's really inspired from a conversation I had with Chrissy Hodges, who's a co-peer, co-friend of ours, and who's an amazing force in the field of mental health advocate, public speaker, referral resource, consulting, all of that good stuff. And she has two things that she focuses on. She really likes the taboo kind of theme OCDs. That's really what she relates to, but a lot of what she focuses on as well is on the kind of ancillary effects of having OCD, right? That OCD is not an island, and that there can be many things that affect the severity of OCD, and also many kind of almost side effects or consequences that having OCD either for a long period of time, or having a very intense bout of OCD, or just having OCD during periods that we normally form some identity or skills, and you can block that process, OCD can affect a lot. So we started having kind of an initial conversation, and it got me thinking around all of these things that I end up as a clinician treating in my clients that is not directly tied to the symptom reduction of obsessions and compulsions, but are still incredibly common things that pop up. And one of the most common things that pops up is this combination of OCD and trauma-like symptoms, or sometimes even PTSD. There's a few ways that I think that OCD and trauma coincide. And I think that the differences in those ways, I've identified three main patterns so far. The differences in those ways really indicate different treatment paths, and they need to be kind of identified properly as such in order to be treated as such. So the first situation in terms of that kind of a coincision of OCD and trauma is an OCD theme around OCD, right? I don't know if it has a name, so I've kind of colloquially termed it meta OCD. But OCD around OCD is very common. And it can kind of almost look like trauma because it's kind of an obsessive concern and fear around, sometimes around experiencing severe OCD again, right? The kind of feared consequence is this OCD was or is so terrible. I really want to kind of avoid that experience. Oftentimes someone had like an intense bout of OCD and it created such an impact on them that their theme starts to switch to, what if I experience that again? Or what if I experience OCD even worse and I end up in the mental hospital for the rest of my life, or I end up committing suicide, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So a lot of telltale signs of this are like obsessive questions of, you know, am I doing the therapy right? Was this an obsession? Or kind of nuances of, oh, what's the difference between, how do I know if I'm experiencing an intrusive thought or if I'm obsessing, you know, and constantly analyzing that, asking for re-explanations of concepts or rereading psychoeducation or things like that. Oh my goodness, like I just had this thought, is this a new OCD theme? Is my OCD getting worse? How intense is it today? You know, things like that. And the solution for it, I'll go through kind of the general treatment path also. The solution for it is really to treat it like any other OCD theme, right? This is maybe the most standard in terms of those interactions of OCD and trauma that I'm going to outline, where the exposures look like maybe you will experience severe OCD again. Mm. You know, maybe you're not doing the therapy right. Maybe you don't understand things. Maybe me as a clinician, you know, I'm the wrong clinician for you. And because you've chosen me, you know, you're never going to get better. Anything like that, where it helps them kind of tolerate the urge to obsess and compulse as to whether or not they're doing the treatment right, because of the treatement for that. There's two other interactions. Okay. The other kind of interaction is a little more of kind of a trauma reaction to OCD in more of a kind of PTSD manifestation, but I'm not quite sure that it would meet kind of diagnostic criteria for PTSD. Just for the psychoeducation of the listeners out there, you know, with PTSD, according to the DSM, which is what we usually use to diagnose people, it needs to be in reaction to actual or threatened death, serious injury, or sexual violation. So according to the strictest definitions, might not be PTSD. Now, there are some other definitions out there where it's around kind of a perceived or threatened loss of, you know, bodily or sometimes kind of perhaps kind of subjective psychological kind of autonomy. And in that intense OCD, I could certainly see kind of making the case, but it's not the strictest kind of definition. So I just want to be careful around the language there. But still, a loss of control and the helplessness that someone could experience with severe OCD, it can produce a similar kind of PTSD experience. And in a situation like that, although we very rarely use cognitive therapy to treat somebody that has OCD, or at least the OCD symptoms themselves, in a situation like that, it could use some cognitive processing. If it's really kind of the PTSD around the OCD, to understand what about the OCD was so impactful and challenging, to identify the conclusions that somebody made in response to their experience that might be kind of distorted conclusions, like OCD can get so bad that I'd lose all of my agency and control and I wouldn't be able to do anything to deal with it. And using that kind of cognitive therapy to help the client kind of challenge those conclusions that they've made. Now, of course, in contrasting this to the first situation, if they're having obsessive concerns around it, if it's OCD around the OCD, then we treat it with exposure response prevention and that. But if it really does seem like there are legitimate, you know, beliefs that the client holds that, you know, of their kind of fragility, their perceived fragility, that they would be able to handle another bout, sometimes you can go in with some cognitive processing there.
Yeah.
And then the last situation is comorbid PTSD and OCD. Sometimes OCD is so intense that it can lead clients to kind of be in situations that are not situations that they would otherwise choose. But also sometimes a client might have totally unrelated in origin, both PTSD and OCD. In those situations, it doesn't really matter what comes first. There's so many different ways that somebody could end up with both of those diagnoses. I don't think that there are any kind of patterns established. It's two diagnoses that aren't kind of on paper more comorbid than anything else, but they do pop up together in some individuals where they had experienced, you know, a near-death experience or sexual assault or something like that. And they also have a brain that generates OCD. In those situations, and this is kind of well established in the kind of field at this point, the PTSD needs to be treated first. The reason for that is that if you start doing exposures around the OCD, especially if there's any sort of overlap with the OCD theme and the PTSD, you could start triggering a PTSD response. Now, the good news for the treatment of both of those is that treatment for PTSD is oftentimes something called PE, or prolonged exposure. And as the name implies, there's a lot of similarities between prolonged exposure and exposure response prevention. So you don't really have to learn the skills twice. Undoing the prolonged exposure, which is kind of a more slow-paced, kind of a relatively kind of gentle version of exposure compared to exposure and response prevention, in teaching the client the skills to kind of gently, at their own pace, learn to kind of experience the PTSD symptoms without their fight or flight response. They also learn the skills that they're going to later apply to the OCD, so that by the time that you're treating the OCD, you know, that treatment goes much faster. I don't see it as a harder to treat kind of case, but it is important to identify and to be able to kind of know your order of operations there. So those are kind of the three ways that I see those two variables, trauma and OCD, interacting.
Yeah, interesting points. But yeah, with the second point, so not with PTSD being comorbid, but more just having similar symptoms to PTSD.
Yeah.
The other thing is just, you know, is just think of like developmental trauma or complex trauma. Living with OCD, it's like this constant repeated torture at times that could then lead on to what we would call developmental trauma or complex trauma. So even if it's not mirroring PTSD symptoms, there's that nervous system that's being wired through all this repeated, like, how basically of OCD.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, it presents really similarly. And then in terms of like the PTSD-esque responses, right, it's trying to avoid situations that might kind of remind you of those intense experiences, being hyper-vigilant around things. Maybe even other things like nightmares, and it could pretty much fit most of the criteria for PTSD.
Yeah.
Besides that one kind of descriptor variable.
Yeah. True. Yeah. Well, hopefully that helps some people. And of course, trauma/PTSD has a lot of different therapies for it. Okay, so let's talk about identity, right? So
sure.
Living with OCD for so long, whether it's like the earliest memory people have or whether it just hit them later on in life when they were 20 or something. Obviously, if you've had it your whole life, it's going to be shaping your identity because it may knock your confidence. You might be avoiding, or you will be avoiding stuff. So you're probably going to miss out on opportunities in life. You're not going to go for opportunities if you know, self-esteem and stuff has been affected. And then obviously later on in life, there's that, well, I knew who I was and now I don't seem to know who I was. So, and obviously there's many variables, but those are the two that come to my mind. So how do you see this? How does it come up for you and your clients?
Identity? Yeah, I think it comes up a lot, right? there are some people that have OCD and the OCD is kind of gentle to them. Maybe they've already developed a firm identity before the OCD starts to hit. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a side effect or a side character to their life, and they learn how to deal with it and they wrap things up. But for a lot of people, whether the OCD was very intense in one area of their life and really kind of obfuscated their ability to kind of develop and perceive who they are in like one domain, like the way that they relate to other people, or if it was so intense, let's say a really intense batch of contamination OCD where they kind of retreat inward, it might affect multiple domains of their identity development because they're not going out, they're not socializing, but they're not also not kind of conceptualizing that they could pick the career path that they want or the, you know, charity group that they want to spend time with or the hobbies that they want to develop, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So OCD, especially intense OCD, can really affect our ability to kind of form and understand the identity that is most valuable to us. And a lot of times when the OCD is treated in terms of that order of operations, you know, when somebody has kind of that, you know, has maybe an atrophied sense of identity, the OCD is still treated first. But at the same time, when we free up, and sometimes an extraordinary amount of space and time is freed up, when we start to free up those resources, sometimes OCD can be like a gas where it'll just expand to fill whatever volume you provide it, right? So if we just work with these individuals and say, okay, you're not obsessing and compulsing anymore. That was your entire life identity. That was your hobbies. That was your relationship. And now you have 10 free hours a day. Good luck. Goodbye. You know, it's, we're not only are we setting them up in a situation that they're likely to kind of experience OCD again, because they have nothing else to do and that's all their default is, but we're denying them the opportunity to capitalize on this moment, for growth and for, development that would be incredibly important and meaningful for their lives. So, in those situations, whether it's in one domain, oh, I don't really know what a relationship would look like in a non-obsessive way, or I don't really know what career choice I want. I've always been afraid that I would say the wrong thing and kind of get canceled. So I really haven't let myself think of anything that's not a work from home job. Or it's multiple domains. I really don't know what me going into the outside world would be like. It's a very common goal of therapy with the clients that I work with to intentionally start to assess, and this is where ACT comes in. You know, Hayes has developed some great kind of values questionnaires where you go and you go through several domains and you figure out what is important to you, why, where are you successful, where are you not, and you could kind of figure that out in a structured way. But yeah, to identify with the clients all of those kind of answers to those questions. What is important to you? In an ideal world, if you know you didn't have intrusive thoughts or if you didn't care about them, what would you choose? And then helping them in that direction could be incredibly important. I think that one other phrase that has come to mind very frequently since one of my clients invented it, and I know that she's an avid listener to this show, so shout out to her in a HIPAA-protected way, is perceived fragility. And I think that's an amazing way to describe this characteristic that a lot of people with OCD develop, perceived fragility, of perceiving that I am too fragile to ask somebody out. I am too fragile to apply to this job. I'm too fragile to go on that hike with my friends, et cetera, et cetera. That historically, that was their perception. That was their identity. That to engage in this task was too much of a challenge for them and they couldn't possibly. And to realize the power and the autonomy that you actually have, that you truly have a choice whether or not to respect or to ascribe relevance to any of the obsessive thoughts or content that your brain and your body is generating, and that you absolutely do have the power and the ability to make whatever choice that you want, is something that's really important to be able to achieve after we've been kind of gaslit into this perceived fragility for sometimes years and years by the OCD.
Yeah, well, yeah, good time. And then thanks to listening to her and everyone else listening. I think there's something about mindset in that of, yeah, well, the OCD can beat that part of our brain we call OCD that can beat us down for so long, and we can get this image of, well, we're weak, or we suffer, and that makes us weak. When actually it's our suffering that makes us strong, you know, the ability to continue, and then that frame of there's nothing weak about you, you know, as opposed to, yeah, maybe if they've adopted that more, I'm a victim, and you know. The other thing that comes to my mind is, obviously with ERP is behavioral therapy. And if we just do behavioral therapy and nothing else, as you're saying, then they're like, well, who am I? And you know, yeah, all this trauma and all this other stuff. And our job as therapists is to help the human, not just work on the OCD. I'm glad you said that. And values, right? How much does that come up for you?
All the time. I think that values is really the way to identify. This is kind of harkening back to the happiness trap and all of Stephen Hayes' work with ACT, but people kind of set their compass as, I want to not experience anxiety, I want to experience happiness and the sense of calm all the time. And that is kind of the addictive striving that really traps people within OCD. When we go through treatment, we start to orient, okay, so what's going to be the replacement for that? Right? It's not that we're stripping your whole life's pursuit and leaving you with nothing, but what is going to be kind of the thing that really drives you, that gives you purpose in life? And for that, we start to go through values. We start to go through what is meaningful to you. At the end of the day, when you're lying in bed, do you think about, I didn't experience a lot of anxiety today? Or do you think about, wow, you know, today was really important. You know, I'm really proud of myself. I really kind of accomplished X or Y, or really lived according to, you know, these values that I had identified. In Liberated Mind, which absolutely, you know, huge shout out to that book, Stephen Hayes' new book, he identifies, and this was something that wasn't clear to me for quite some time, the important difference also between values and goals. Historically, as a clinician, I might have kind of conflated those terms. But I think importantly, he points out that goals are something that are ephemeral, right? They're always in the future, and then we reach them for a second, and then they're in the past. And by the mere ascribing kind of our main compass to goals themselves, we're almost always in a state of deficit where, okay, I want to accomplish that goal right now. That goal is unaccomplished. You know, it's not a very kind of skillful way to measure the quality or the success of our life. And there's also a I'll be happy when mentality, but that's going to be the next topic. So I'll put a pin in that for now. But in terms of values, the way that he describes it is the combination of an adjective and an adverb. So kind of loving compassionately, or working mindfully, or creating tenaciously, you know. It's the way in which you value navigating throughout life, that kind of descriptor of that process, which is going to be the new measure of our success. This is the way that I want to connect to other people, that I want to pursue my art, that I want to pursue my career, my hobbies, be in nature, be spiritual, et cetera, et cetera. And if we define kind of our success based off of that, that is something that could be achieved at any moment. And if you've slipped up, you can regain footing on in any moment. It's a much more stable, pragmatic, and useful way of kind of setting our North Star.
Did you see my social post last week?
No.
I talked about values as our North Star.
Oh, you know what? A
patient
sent that to me.
I'm just curious.
Yeah. A patient sent that to me, and she was like, this is such a mirror of our session, because we had just had a session. We had talked about that. Mm. She saw your post on social media.
Nice.
I bet that's why that phrase is in my head, actually. So,
well, yeah, I didn't coin it. I think it came from somewhere else. I think it's true. Values, we're guided second by second by them if we want to be. And that's when I do identity work with clients, even with clients who don't have OCD, and I work with teens, and often teens don't know who they are. And
sure.
Of course, they don't need to. That age, you're really figuring it out. And obviously, everyone's trying to tell you who you are. And and I kind of say, firstly, we kind of work out what their values are, roughly. I don't think there's any concrete way of knowing what your values are, but you get a rough feel, what feels right. And it's like, just try over the next week, living each day, remind yourself of those values. Have I met these values today? Am I living by them in various ways? Mm-hmm. And in theory, I say, I can't predict it, but if you spend more of your time living by these values, I assume you're going to have a better week, or that's my prediction.
Sure.
And it's the same with me. You know, one of my values is playfulness. And I know that when I'm not being playful, that day is not as good. Mm-hmm. So I try and remind myself, oh, can I be a bit more playful? Or I'm taking this too seriously, or whatever it is. And then the more I live by those types of values, that makes my life better.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, in terms of kind of painting what a life like this looks like, when we talk to clients around not directly pursuing happiness or a sense of calm, we're not prescribing the stoic lifestyle where we're absconding any of that kind of importance on emotions. But by living life according to our values, we create that byproduct much more frequently. If you're directly pursuing that byproduct of happiness, that's when it's like trying to fall asleep kind of situation, where it's just going to make it kind of impossible to come.
Yeah. Good point. Okay. Is there anything else on identity you want to say before we move on?
Let me check my notes. I think it's everything on OCD and identity that will ever be thought and will ever be said. We've completely covered.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. Exhausted it.
Closed topic.
Yeah. So let's talk about grief, in particular processing grief, and grief in the terms of loss and loss of everything from OCD, you know, loss of opportunities, loss of friends, loss of everything OCD has ever kind of interfered with or taken away from someone. Loss of moments of joy and happiness, and the list goes on. So big question, but how do you come to terms with loss in this way?
I think there's two ways, actually, that I really see kind of grief and acceptance of OCD to apply. One is in the past tense, and another is in the kind of conceptualized future. So I'll talk about that past tense that you just kind of described first. Yeah, there are a lot of folks that are really kind of compelled to revisit and could use help processing how much OCD has taken from them. You know, some people it's like waking up after treatment from like a 20-year coma of, you know, where did my life go? And in that sense, it's, you know, grief work and grief and processing of that is necessary in the same way of any other loss, of really kind of coming to terms with the experience and its magnitude and how much that it affected you. Certainly trying to kind of see it in a more gestalt, kind of a more kind of whole, in terms of the things that you, the lessons that you had learned from it, how you can make that experience not entirely kind of useless and miserable, but how you can gain utility and a sense of meaning from the pain and the suffering that you did. Maybe even future-oriented activities that would be valuable for you in capitalizing off of that meaning. You know, a lot of people that experienced very intense OCD for a long period of time find a lot of meaning joining the community of people that are helping others with OCD. They go on to become therapists or peer counselors or things like that because they want to help others who have gone through a similar experience. They can deeply empathize, and it gives them kind of a lot of strength and unique skill set. So it's, you know, the work is going to look different for each individual, but figuring out, you know, what are those most painful points? How can we first express them, process them, you know, empathize with them and be kind to them? And also, how can we kind of make meaning from them? It's going to be an important part of the work. I think that's almost work that's done after therapy has been successful in other ways, right? Because at first the client is like, how do I achieve success? How do I achieve success? And then once they do and they realize, oh, success was always achievable, that's when the grief work happens. The other type of grief, the kind of conceptualized future sense of grief, sometimes has to happen at the onset of work. So what I mean by that in terms of grief and acceptance of OCD for the conceptualized future is that oftentimes people hold and white knuckle onto a I'll be happy when mentality of the future. And with OCD, OCD is a incredibly challenging and painful experience, but it offers this really alluring fantasy that keeps people stuck in it. And that fantasy is you can achieve certainty. And when you do, you will live happily ever after, right? It promises almost this kind of in this black and white way of your life will be terrible if you don't figure this out. The flip side of that is your life will be amazing if you do. You know, once you figure it out, you're never going to have intrusive thoughts again. You're never going to have a significant anxiety that concerns you again. This is the one thing that you really have to kind of figure out in your life. And once you've done that, it's over. I realized, you know, hearkening back to kind of our first conversation today, in terms of my relationship with OCD, I had gone through at some point my journals. I had, like, you know, as an obsessive perfectionist, I had kept a lot of journals over the course of my life. And at every point in my life, there were many journal entries talking about, you know, my relationship with whatever partner that I was trying to pursue or that I was in a relationship with. And this kind of just dreaming this fantasy of I will be happy when. So it really contextualizes why my OCD was so intense, right? I had built up this moment of I will be happy when, I will be happy when, of like marriage itself. And when I realized that my partner had flaws like every other person and that my life was still going to experience distress like every other person is going to experience, not only did I have to deal with kind of the OCD, but it was this kind of revelation of what life actually will look like that I had to come to terms with, that rationally I certainly understood, but kind of emotionally and on some different level, it was still this fantasy that I hadn't fully kind of let go of. And I think grieving the loss of that fantasy of the perfect life, of being able to get certainty and live that flawless, happily ever after, needs to be done for some people to commit to the therapy itself. Because committing to the therapy promises what the brain conceptualizes as a far worse life path. If you deal with things the OCD way, it's perfect. But this clinician is telling me that I'm going to have intrusive thoughts on and off forever. Why would I want to choose that solution over the one that my brain has been proposing that's so alluring? And that is some grief and acceptance work that often needs to be done, of understanding the true nature of our brains, the true reality of what living life is, of course, of recontextualizing it, that it doesn't end up being this depressing stoic thing, but it ends up being this beautiful, meaningful process that does bring, in the end of the day, much more happiness and peace of mind than the OCD path. You know, it's better in basically every way, but you do need to give up that fantasy.
Yes, I'm glad you said that. What came to my mind is like the fantasy is like what we'd call candy floss, or I think for you is cotton candy.
Yeah,
the big sugary mess of like fluff.
Yes.
Yeah. Obviously, it's delicious. It's sweet when you're a kid, especially you want to eat it. I'm sure as an adult, I haven't had it for many, many years, but okay. I'm sure I would want to eat it. But it doesn't fill you up. You get hungry quickly. It also probably gives you a rush that you don't want, you know, or your sugar drop, whatever it is. I don't understand the physiological, but I guess where I'm going with this is that's kind of like the fantasy. It promises a lot, but really it's empty. And as you get to the more meaning in the case of relationship OCD, the reality of an actual relationship, the partner's not perfect. There's going to be arguments, you know, but there's also going to be a much deeper connection than the candy floss or fantasy could ever give you.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So it's giving up, trying to give up that fantasy or be okay. Also see through it. It's not just grieving the loss, but seeing through that it was a myth all along. You know, it's just this sugary illusion that couldn't ever fulfill you.
100%. And it applies not only to relationship OCD, but everything, you know, with perfectionism or with, you know, contamination fears or identity fears. You know, if I was sure that I wasn't a pedophile, or if I was sure of my sexuality, if I was sure that I didn't have cancer or HIV or now monkeypox or anything like that, you know, then I would be totally fine. And all of my anxiety is just because I haven't figured this out, you know. That's all this kind of beautiful, alluring fantasy that's proposed by the mind.
Yeah. I hear that so much, even from people around me, not even my clients. Like,
it's
a nice fantasy, but you hold on to
it. I'll be happy when mentality. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I've been there myself.
Sure.
So I guess something else I wanted to add onto like loss and grief is, if we just think grief and loss generally of when you lose someone in the traditional way of looking at grief and loss, it's time as well, right? So just allowing that time heals, as cliche as that is.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to take time. And then something else we haven't talked about, both in context of trauma and grief and loss, is compassion, right? It's compassion for yourself in that trauma, compassion for yourself in the loss of opportunities and the fantasy. And
100%. You know, a lot of times grief comes with a whole host of feelings, right? In TV and movies, it's this kind of intense thing that happens homogeneously, where there's a lot of crying and then this catharsis and the person's over it. But it's not like that at all. It comes with basically every emotion, you know, on the whole spectrum, and it'll flux and flow. And absolutely, it does take time.
Yeah, true. So, okay, so you kind of, we're going to kind of talk about psychoeducation around what's normal. And again, I'm doing speech marks because that word's silly, but
sure.
What's statistically average, maybe? Where am I going with this? So you kind of mentioned it there around your relationship of learning that actually this is kind of what a relationship is. So kind of anything else you want to say on this topic?
Yeah, I think this topic kind of really directly applies to the other two, right? Where we can obsess around things so long that we can, not flesh out kind of our identity on certain things. We have perceived fragility that prevents us from acting in certain directions. And we can kind of think around and obsess around a topic so much that we kind of lose all sense of reality as to what it is. So although a lot of OCD clinicians might be tempted to answer every question that the client is asking with, are you obsessing? I think you're compulsing right now. You know, let's just tolerate the uncertainty that you might not know that answer. Some clients might legitimately not know that answer. In terms of that topic of relationships, some clients might not know legitimately how do people without OCD generally make that decision as to what is a healthy relationship, what is a relationship that is like quote like good enough. How do you decide whether or not to stick with a relationship or other interpersonal skills, such as, I'm having a conversation with my boss. Historically, over the course of my whole life, I've been incredibly fearful of rejection or somebody kind of thinking something ill of me. So I've developed this very specific way of making requests or a very kind of passive communication style. I literally don't know the skills on how to communicate more directly with COVID or, you know, any other kind of things going on. I really don't know at this point because I've read so many different blogs, so many different opinions. I've gone through kind of the CDC and all of these different sources. I really don't know what the kind of average non-obsessive consensus is on like when to wash your hands and how often, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, we don't always use that metric, right? I think a more valuable metric is what is your best guess as to what you would do if you didn't have OCD, because you might choose what the standard or what the normative approach is, and that's fine. You know, there's all of this variance and you get to choose whatever. But in some of those cases, it can be useful to provide either that education around a more kind of non-OCD normative response, or building up some basic skills that the client might have missed out on developing, like that interpersonal communication, deciding healthy relationships, deciding how often do I see a doctor and when, that the client might have missed out on being able to develop because the OCD was so severe in that area.
Yeah, good point. And of course, they'll learn a lot of those answers over time. But obviously, sure, if they can learn them quicker, it's going to serve them and help them. So it's something we should be mindful of in therapy.
Yeah.
Both as therapist and client.
Yeah.
And even asking as a client, I'm not sure in this area, what do you think? And then you can figure that out together.
Yeah. Mm. And think of, sometimes it's important to answer the questions directly. And sometimes to that point, it's more important to point to the process of how do we kind of seek answers to questions that we don't know of and kind of guide down that path instead.
Good point. Yeah, good point. Okay, so this has been, I think, a really informative podcast that I think hopefully will help many, many people. So is there anything else you wish you could have said today on any of this?
I think that this is kind of tip of the iceberg in terms of, OCD is not a monolith. It's not an island. it's affected and affects many different domains. And sometimes behavioral treatment does get a bad rap for being mechanical, for being cookie cutter. Mm-hmm. And it's incredibly important to see the person as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, as one unit. All right. Well, thank you so much for your wisdom and expertise.
Thank
you. Great to cover this.
With pleasure. I think, another shout out is that if anyone is in the New York area, I've just expanded the practice and I'm trying to offer some more affordable treatments. So treating some folks that are offering sessions at $100 at its lowest. And if you can't quite reach that, let me know and we'll try to make things work. I want to make sure to kind of expand some treatment access for a lot more people as kind of my career develops. So absolutely. Thank you.
Cool,
thank nice. You for the opportunity. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, no worries. I'll put your link in the show notes as well so people can check that out. And I'll speak soon.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care. Thank you.